So here's how this goes. If this goes well, you can give God all the glory. If this goes very poorly, it's Brother Victor's fault. We all understand that, right? He'll understand in a minute. It'll make perfect sense to him. So I'm going to give you more than 5 seconds to turn to Isaiah chapter 12. I love the fact that he gave us 5 seconds, counted it down, and then didn't read it for 10 minutes. I thought that was great. That's great. Kind of had you on edge and then just kind of left you hanging there for a while to keep you. I thought that was good. Isaiah chapter 12. We're going to back up a little bit when we get into this. After we read the first verse, we're probably going to back up into Isaiah 11. We're going to bounce around a little bit. We're going to end up in Isaiah chapter 40. And we may bounce to some other scriptures. I just don't know how well this is going to go. I haven't planned this out in great detail, so I don't know how the timing is going to work. So we'll just see how it goes. Maybe we'll just stay here till 1 or 2. I don't know. We'll figure that out. Isaiah chapter 12. And in that day thou shalt say, O Lord, I will praise thee. Though thou wast angry with me, thine anger is turned away, and thou comfortest me. Okay. So the real challenge for us right now is in understanding this and being able to internalize this and being able to get something out of this, which I believe is a very comforting message in this sense. Yeah, I think it meshes well with what Mike was talking about. He was talking about our focus. This is kind of trying to turn our attention to where it should be in a lot of ways. So I think it'll mesh pretty well with that. But the challenge that sits before us is how we interpret that very first set of words. What do we do with that? And in that day, how do we deal with that? Okay, let's lay a little groundwork here. Let's make sure we understand something, because Isaiah is a very interesting character. He does a lot of work around a particular theme, but I want to make sure we understand the relationship between him and that theme. Isaiah prophesied probably in somewhere around the 8th century B.C., 740, 750 years before the coming of Christ. Okay? So he prophesied through the reign of King Uzziah and a few others. Doesn't matter who they are, just know we're some 740, 750 years before the coming of Christ. David was king over Israel in probably the 10th century B.C. So what I'm trying to get at here, what I really want you to grab a hold to, you don't have to remember all those details. There won't be a test at the end. No dates to remember or anything like that. This isn't a history class. This is a spiritual lesson. But what will help you a little bit is to know that Isaiah is probably 200 years after David. David's reign's over. It's been over for a long time. He's dead and buried. His body is in a grave somewhere. Obviously, his soul and spirit has gone back to God from whence it came. And now Isaiah is talking. But boy, Isaiah spends a lot of time and uses David and his lineage in many of his prophecies and conversations. It's a big theme of his, and right here is no different. So let's go back to chapter 11. I think it'll help us to understand what in that day means. That's what we're getting at right now. What does it mean when he says in that day? What day are we talking about? So you go back to the beginning of chapter 11, it says, and there shall come forth a rod out of the stem of Jesse. Jesse, father of David. Isaiah is using the idea of the growth of a tree or a vine or something of that nature as a metaphor for the lineage of David's family. And he says, and there shall come forth a rod, a stick, if you will, a branch, if you want to call it that, a bud that shoots off in growth. There shall come forth a rod out of the stem of Jesse, and a branch shall grow out of his roots. He says, and the Spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him, and the spirit of wisdom and understanding, the spirit of counsel and might, the spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord, and shall make him of quick understanding in the fear of the Lord, and he shall not judge after the sight of his eyes, neither reprove after the hearing of his ears, but with righteousness shall he judge the poor and reprove with equity for the meek of the earth. And he shall smite the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips shall he slay the wicked. Now, a casual reader that doesn't understand the timing and pictures that are going on here, or the arrangement of how things were laid out, or the chronology, if you will, of the various books and people, might conclude that what Isaiah was talking about was the reign of King David. But this, my child, is 200 years later. It's not David and it's not Solomon that is the subject of this prophecy that Isaiah is laying out. Listen, he says in verse 5, and righteousness shall be the girdle of his loins, and faithfulness the girdle of his reins. Now we're going to skip down a little bit to verse 10. Because we're going to find a commonality between that and what we read at the beginning of verse 12. He says, and in that day, child of grace, I submit to you that he's repeating what he said in verse 1. Listen to what he says. And in that day there shall be a root of Jesse, a different metaphor, same prophecy. There shall be a root of Jesse which shall stand for an ensign of the people. Now here's something that you'll never hear read, and I'm not trying to be insulting, I'm just stating the facts, that you'll never hear read in a Jewish synagogue. He says, and in that day there shall be a root of Jesse which will stand for an ensign, a sign, an emblem, something to grab people's attention. And it says, an ensign of the people. To it shall the Gentiles seek, and his rest shall be glorious. Ah, brothers and sisters, this prophecy is not about David. It's not about Solomon. It's not about some other natural offshoot of the lineage of Jesse or David or Solomon or any other non-divine human being. This prophecy is none other than Jesus Christ himself, the divine one who came here and took upon himself a body of flesh and became the God-man, fully God, fully man, totally divine, and yet human in nature, but without sin. That's who it's talking about. So when we say in that day, in context, he's talking about the day of Christ. More specifically and more generally, he is talking about in chapter 12, the gospel day. Right? One of my favorite pictures in the Old Testament, Brother Mike's asked me a lot about primitive Baptists and how we feel about types and shadows and how we look at things. So I'm going to tell you how we feel about it right now. One of my favorite pictures in the Old Testament is when the high priest goes into the holiest of holies on the Day of Atonement. If you remember, he's wearing an ephod. And around the base of that ephod are bells and pomegranates. And you can imagine, I'm glad we don't have to do this as preachers today. You can imagine that as he walked, he jingled. Everywhere he went, the bells would beat against the pomegranates and he made this jingling noise. And everybody knew where he was. And I can imagine, especially in the days of the tabernacle, when we were talking about a cloth-walled building, that when the high priest would go in on the Day of Atonement one time a year to do the labor that only he could do, he would walk into the outer room of the tabernacle, the first room on the outside of the veil, and the people would be gathered around. If they were faithful in any way, they'd be gathered around waiting. And they could hear him as he shuffled about getting ready to go into the holiest of holies. And they could hear the bells jingling against the pomegranates and all the high priests. And then suddenly, there would be a clatter of noise, because as I understand it, and maybe I'm wrong, I accept the fact that I can be wrong, but I don't think I am on this one. There would be a clatter of noise, and he would remove the ephod and lay it aside. Right. And suddenly, it would go silent. You ever get a picture of the 3 hours of darkness in your head when that happens? The clatter of noise that led up to that moment. Do you think about the trials that Jesus went through? The scourging, the plaiting of the crown of thorns, the hammers that were driving the nails through the palms of his hands and through his feet. Can you imagine the clattering of noise that went on? And then suddenly, God turns the lights out on the world and everything goes silent. So too, the high priest would take that ephod off, lay it aside, and there was just silence. And Israel would be gathered around the tabernacle waiting. What were they waiting for? Well, they knew that the high priest was going into that place with a lamb without spot and blemish to offer upon that altar an offering for the sins of Israel. And that if God did not accept that offering, the high priest would be struck dead on the spot. So what were they waiting for? They were waiting for him to go in beyond the veil and then to come back out. You see it? Jesus going into the grave. And we waited for him to come back out. And they waited out there as that process went on. And they were waiting for him to go within the veil. They were waiting for him to come back out. And what was proof to them? What was evidence to them of his imminent return from that labor? It was when he would stop outside of the veil. He would reach over. He would pick up that ephod. And the bells would beat against the pomegranates one more time. And they would hear it. And maybe the folks that were in the back, farthest away from the tabernacle, could not hear the sound of it. But the folks in the front would hear it. And what would the message be? They would turn to the people behind them. And they would announce with confidence that the high priest lives. And the message would go back through the crowd. It would be translated from person to person, place to place, as they began to share that message. The same today. By the way, do you know what that represents, Rod? It's the gospel message. That's the purpose of the gospel message. In its totality, in its simplicity, it is the message that has been cascading down through time from heart to heart, from mouth to ear, from child of grace to child of grace, declaring one succinct, consistent truth, and that is that Jesus lives. Isn't that incredible? The very picture of what we're living today was painted by God in the ceremonial law service. Isn't that beautiful? Well, I've gotten way off track. Way off track. So this is about the gospel age. This is about the gospel age. He says, and in that day, in the day of the gospel church, it's the church age. In that day, thou shalt say, we, children of God, this is what we should say. This is what we shall say. He says, O Lord, I will praise thee. Our God, as Brother Mike has so well said this morning, our God in the person of Jesus Christ is worthy of praise. He's worthy of our praise. There is nothing more we can do. Matter of fact, that's why we're here today. That's not only why we're here in this room today. That's why we exist today. We're here to praise and bring glory and honor to the God of heaven that sent Jesus Christ. We're to glorify His Son. We're to elevate Him. We're to lift Him up. Not that the lack of our praise lowers Him in any way, but that's why we were made. Amen. Child of grace, don't just believe me. Go over to Isaiah chapter 43. Isaiah chapter 43, starting in verse 5, it says, "Fear not, for I am with thee. I will bring thy seed from the east and gather them from the west. I will say to the north, give up, and to the south, keep not back. Bring my sons from far and my daughters from the ends of the earth." Oh, child of God, that ought to be a comforting verse to you today, to know that God is the one that is gathering His people, not some weak-kneed, poor-minded preacher like myself. I'm not the one that's responsible for gathering the people of God from the various corners of this world. Oh, don't get me wrong. I want to preach the gospel to anybody that'll stand still long enough to listen. I want to tell them about Jesus. I want them to know what God has done for them. But it's not me that has to gather His people and bring them into the fold. No, God is gathering them. He will not allow the north to keep them, nor the south be allowed to not give them up. He's going to bring them in, but listen to what He says after that. He says, "For everyone that is called by my name," verse 7, "everyone that is called by my name, for I have created him," what? "For my glory. I have formed him, yea, I have made him." Do you realize that you sit here today as a created being of the God of the universe, created for one purpose and one thing only, and that is for the purpose of giving praise and honor and glory to the God of heaven. There is nothing like Him in this world. There is nothing like Him in any other faith or religion. There is nothing like Jesus. You can ask me what makes what we believe different than what everybody else believes, and I'll tell you right now, I can take you out there and show you the grave of Muhammad. He died and he was buried. He lies there today. His bones are crumbling to dust. I can carry you over to the Far East, and we can go to places where people gather at the place that they consider to be the graveside of Confucius. His bones are in the ground. He breathes no more. He's dead and he's gone. His writings are still read, but there's no life in him. I can carry you to the place that they think Buddha fell. I can show you all these other faiths, but I'll tell you what, I cannot take you to the place where Jesus' body lies. Why? Because he's not dead, child of grace. He rose from the tomb, victorious over death, hell, and the grave. That's the difference between what we believe and what everybody else believes. We're not following a dead man. No, our God is alive. He's the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac. He's the God of Jacob, and he is your God, my child. Amen. Don't ever forget that. Our God lives, and he is worthy of our praise. He's worthy of our praise. He says, "Behold, God is my salvation." Back to chapter 12. "Behold, God is my salvation." By the way, this is a song. This isn't just words. This is a song. "O Lord, I will praise thee. Though thou wast angry with me, thine anger is turned away." How was God's anger turned away in the gospel age? It was turned away by the labor and work of Jesus Christ on the cross of Calvary. Isn't that something? "Thine anger is turned away. Thou comfortest me. Behold, God is my salvation." God is my salvation. "I will trust and not be afraid. For the Lord Jehovah is my strength and my song. He also is become my salvation." And then there's this verse. This is one I really wanted to get to. I ain't got but about 11 minutes left. This is one I wanted to get to. "Therefore with joy shall ye draw water out of the wells of salvation." Oh boy, wells of salvation. I started chasing that. I started running that down a little bit. And boy, I'm going the wrong direction.
So I want to share something with you that just kind of fascinated me. Let's go over to Jeremiah chapter 2. This is talking about water out of the wells. Listen to that. Keep that in mind. Draw water out of the wells of salvation. So let's go over to Jeremiah chapter 2 for a second. I want to show you something that I think is just fascinating to me. Jeremiah chapter 2, if I can get my fingers to work this morning. Jeremiah chapter 2, we're going to jump down to about, verse 13 or so, I think it is. Maybe we'll back up a little bit from there. No, we'll just read verse 13. He says, for my people, listen to this. This is God talking, God, Lord Jehovah God. He says, for my people have committed two evils. They have forsaken, listen to this, they have forsaken me, the fountain of living waters. You see what he's saying? See what God's saying? God is calling himself something. Here's a name of God that you may not have thought of. This is God the Father talking to Israel, and he says, listen, there's two things that they've done, two evils that they have committed. And he says, one is they have forsaken me, and we're only going to deal with one. They have forsaken me, the fountain, actually we'll deal with both of them, forsaken me, the fountain of living waters. You realize that the Bible calls God the Father a fountain of living waters. God the Father called himself a fountain of living waters. He said one evil that these people had done is that they had forsaken that fountain. Do you know what the other evil was? Well, he goes on to tell us when we read a little bit farther. It says, and hewed them out cisterns, broken cisterns that can hold no water. So they had two faults against them, two evils that they had done. One was they had forsaken the very God of heaven. They had forsaken the fountain of living waters, which was God. But in replacement of that, they had dug their own wells. Oh, doesn't that sound familiar to you today? I see that going on so much in our world today. I see it so much in my own life. We find things to replace God. We have access to a fountain of living waters, a fountain that flows so freely, that is so deep, and always flows with living water. Water that will console us, water that will satisfy us. But no, we forsake that, child of grace, because of the nature that we still have. How do we forsake it? We go dig our own wells. And they're dry wells. What kind of wells do we dig? Well, some of us spend the vast majority of our time and effort seeking financial success, as an example. We focus our life and our attention on being successful. I remember as a teenage boy growing up, I had no interest in spiritual things. I had a plan, though. I had a real plan. I was a pretty smart kid at the time. I had really good grades. I excelled at academic things. And I had a plan. I was going to go to college. I was going to get my degree. I was going to find a profession. And I was going to retire by the time I was 40. That was my plan right there. It was all about financial success. Well, I'll tell you what. I'm nearly 60 years old. And I'm living in a camper behind the church while I try to build a house. And I've got a job. I don't think I'll be able to get rid of it until I'm at least 67 at this point. So let's just say I failed at that. That well had no water in it. That's the truth. That well caused me more trouble than it did good. We often dig wells out of popularity. Today is the age of popularity, isn't it not? Yes. The more people you can get eyeballs from to look at you, the more chance you got of making it as the next YouTube star. Boy, it's a popularity contest on YouTube, isn't it? I've got a guy that I follow a good bit that I enjoy watching on YouTube. I'm not against YouTube at all. Don't get me wrong. I've got a guy that I like to watch. He's a woodworker. He's entertaining. He's funny. He's kind of a slapstick comedian, kind of throwback to the old Three Stooges days, right? So he did a video the other day. He's been building a new house himself, so he's moved his shop from one place to another. So for about the past year, he hasn't done a whole lot of woodworking videos. So he did one the other day, and it fell on its face. I mean, he's got millions of viewers, and he did one the other day. I've never seen one of his videos get that many complaints. People hated it. And he said, you know, he actually did a video yesterday that I watched where he apologized. Because he said, we knew. He said, normally we have like 8 hours of footage that we edit down to get, you know, a decent 1 hour video for you to do. He said, in this case, we only had an hour and a half of footage. We tried to just go over the top and make it as funny as possible. And it was so ridiculous that nobody liked it. That's where we are today, right? He's out there apologizing because he put out a video that other people didn't like. Isn't that funny? Why? Because eyeballs equal success. How many subscribers you have, how many followers you have on Instagram, how many subscribers you have on whatever, how many followers you have on whatever format, or how many friends you have on Facebook, right? That's what it's all about. That's a dry well, because it can fall apart in a hurry. We live in a world where people have dug a well out of politics. Isn't that something? People looking to politicians for salvation. I thought we knew that politicians weren't worth the salt. You know? Never understood that. People have made a well out of politics. They think that politicians are going to solve our problems. They haven't solved a single problem since the day I was born. Either side. I don't get it. Government. That's another place people look to for wells of water. Let me tell you something. There is no salvation in human government. God tolerates it. Go look at the vision that Daniel had in chapter 7 about these horrible beasts rising up out of the water, and each one represented a nation. That's how God sees human government. Then go back and look at the vision that Nebuchadnezzar had, where he saw that beautiful large statue with a golden head. And that's how governments see themselves. That's not how God sees them. But notice that the Bible refers to God the Father as a well of water. Now let's go over to John chapter 4 for a second. Let's see if we can get through these really quick. John chapter 4. I'll give myself 5 seconds. John chapter 4. That was supposed to be funny. Nobody laughed. Sorry. Wasn't a single laugh in the room. Wasn't even a dad joke, and I didn't get a laugh. Okay. Not going well at this point. John chapter 4. Start reading in verse 13. And start reading with the words of Jesus. He says, Whosoever drinketh of this water shall thirst again. This is the woman at the well, the Samaritan woman at the well. He says, whosoever drink of this water, the water in that well, they'll thirst again. But whosoever drinketh of the water that I shall give them, or I shall give him, shall never thirst. But the water that I shall give him shall be in him a well of water springing up unto everlasting life. So this water is something that Jesus gives. So what comes forth from Jesus? The Spirit of God. If I go away, I'll not leave you comfortless, but I'll send you another comforter. It is not wrong to say that Jesus is in us. That's not wrong. He is in us in the person of the Holy Spirit. Right? All three members of the Trinity are God. Persons of the Trinity are God. So it's not wrong to say that Jesus is in us, but he will give us, he says, the Spirit. And notice what it says here. It says of the Spirit that this Spirit that comes is water that's given to us, and when we get it, we'll never thirst, but it'll spring up in us like a well of water springing up. In other words, it's an internal thing. The Spirit comes and dwells inside of us, and inside of us it sources as a well of water springing up inside of us. And he says, if you have that water, you'll never thirst. Well, what in the world does that mean? I mean, I'm thirsty right now. Well, he's not talking about natural thirst. He's not talking about something that can solve. I mean, that can solve a lot, right? It can wet a parched lip. It can soothe a dry, raspy throat. But it can't solve the inner yearnings of a broken heart that sees itself as an undone, broken sinner, that feels the weight, the crushing weight of who he is by nature. It can't help the soul that has been awakened to the reality of sin and come to the realization that in and of themselves there is no hope. That they can't overcome their guilt. That no amount of penance will ever repay God for what they have done. They've come to the place where they understand that they are hopeless in this world and without hope. This can't solve that. You can't fix that. But oh, child of grace, God gives us, Jesus gives us a wellspring of water within us, he says, that will cause us to never thirst again. There's a couple of ways I can look at that. One is that it means that we'll never thirst after the lusts of our former life. I never thought about it that way. Until I was praying about this and reading the scripture over and over again, I thought, oh, this could be talking about the fact that when I'm born again and when I hear the gospel, once I've been enlightened to what Jesus has done, once I've been enlightened and the Spirit of God is inside of me, that I can now see that there is something better and I don't want to turn back to those things that were back there, that it can help me overcome the thirst that I once had for the lusts and sins of this world, the things that I once did gladly and gleefully and rejoiced in others doing with me, I now abhor and turn away from and push back. Not that I'm no longer a person of sin, not that I no longer have a nature of sin, and not that I don't sometimes look back at the world and think, oh, I'm no better than the Egyptians that were pulled out of Egypt in the Exodus. And once they got out there a little ways in their journey, they looked back upon Egypt and they lusted after the leeks and the houses that they dwelt in Egypt itself, in spite of the fact that they were slaves in that land. You do realize that that part of the story of the children of Israel being drawn out of Egypt, when they look back and see those things, is a type and shadow of you, child of grace. When your nature causes you to look at this world and lust after it, I know that that is never completely overcome here in this life, but when that wellspring of water of the Spirit of God is in my soul, it curbs that desire. It keeps it in check to some degree. I think that's a beautiful picture. I think also it could be talking about that thirst for grace, that thirst for righteousness. Well, I know that thirst too will never be completely satisfied here in this life. No matter what happens, no matter how much that well springs up in me, the weight of this world comes from time to time. And because of my nature, I turn away from it and lose the impact of that wellspring of water that's within me, at least in a temporal way. But child of God, there's coming a day when Jesus will return from the heavens with a shout. The voice of the archangel will sound and our thirst will be no more. That wellspring of water will cause us to, we'll be satisfied. Right? We'll no longer have to drink anymore, even from that well, because we'll be living in it and we'll be satisfied. I love the fact that it's referred to as a well, by the way. I haven't mentioned that. The idea is that it's deep and it's plenty and it overflows. And I'll just tell you in a second how much it overflows. Let me get past one more verse of scripture. Let's go back to the Song of Solomon, chapter 4. Not far from Isaiah 12, by the way. If you just go backwards a little bit, you'll find the Song of Solomon. Song of Solomon, chapter 4. This is a book I don't hear preached out of much anymore, but it is a beautiful book. And in Song of Solomon, chapter 4, verse 15. I want to go here because we've already read out of Jeremiah how that the Bible refers to God the Father as a wellspring of water. We've heard how that out of the book of John, it refers to the Spirit of God as a wellspring of water. Now I want you to go to Song of Solomon chapter 4. Look at verse 15. It says, "And a fountain of gardens, a well of living waters, and streams from Lebanon." Now, a lot of people read this particular chapter. I've got to do a little bit of background here. And they think this is the church talking to, or this is Jesus talking to the church, because that's what was going on a little bit earlier. Certainly in verse 12, it says, "A garden enclosed is my sister, my spouse, a spring shut up, a fountain sealed." Now that is certainly Jesus Christ, the Son of the living God, talking about his bride, a garden, his sister. But notice, she's the garden. But the one in verse 15 is the source of the gardens. You see it? Verse 15 says, "A fountain of gardens, a well of living waters, and streams from Lebanon." And I want you to notice it says a fountain of gardens. He is the base, foundation, source, creator, and builder of every single local church that is truly a church of Jesus Christ. He is the fountain of the gardens. And notice it refers to Jesus here as a well of living waters. Isn't that beautiful? One more verse, and we'll try to wrap this up. I know we're out of time. We got to be out of time. Oh, yeah, way past. Sorry. One more verse. Let's go over to John chapter 7, verse 38, and we'll draw this out. John chapter 7, verse 38. My apologies. Brother Mike did a really good job with the time, and I am just blowing it out of the water here. And I know everybody is just completely shocked that I messed this up. John chapter 7. John chapter 7, let me make sure I've got the right place here. John chapter 7, verse 38. It says, we'll go back to verse 37. It says, "In the last day, that great day of the feast, Jesus stood and cried, saying, 'If any man thirst,'" listen, "'if any man thirst, let him come unto me and drink.'" If any man thirst, let him come unto me and drink. Then he tells us what it means to come in this context. Please don't carry this definition of come to any other context than this one, because it'll confuse you. But in this context, this is what he means by come. "If any man thirst, let him come unto me and drink. He that believeth on me," that's what it means to come. "He that believeth on me, as Scripture has said," listen, "out of his belly shall flow rivers of living water." Why? Because the Spirit's there. He won't thirst because he has a source within himself. And all he says is to have access to this well. In the words of Brother Mike, don't lose focus. Spiritually, don't lose focus. Believe. There's nothing wrong with a preacher encouraging people to believe. I'm not trying to get you to believe so that you can go to heaven. I'm trying to get you to believe so that you'll have access to those waters that are overflowing. And notice, they're not just flowing. His belly shall flow rivers of living water. They are overflowing. They're more than we can contain. That's why we're supposed to share it. Because we're not losing anything by sharing. May you find grace and peace in the message of God's gospel. And may you find Jesus worthy of your praise. And may I encourage you to come to Him. Believe. Trust Him. And your thirst will be satisfied. May God bless you is my prayers. We're going to stand on our feet and sing. Let's just sing one verse of How Firm a Foundation. And if there be anybody here that's heard the gospel message this morning that wants to commit their life to Christ, would like to follow Him in baptism, you just come down front while we sing this one verse of this hymn and say, "Brother Marty, I want to come home." And we'll handle it from there.